Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and tonight's conversation is with Mark Grossman, Director General of the Foreign Service and Director of Human Resources at the U.S. Department of State. And joining me in the conversation is Patty Fisher, another PwC partner. Patty?
Mark, how can the State Department meet the needs of dual career families, given the complexities and the various locations around the world that you have to contend with?
Well, Patty, we have two challenges, actually. Challenge number one is to deal with the complexities of dual career families, dual career couples who are both in the Foreign Service. And I make sure that all the information is out there. I'm part of a dual career couple. My spouse is also a Foreign Service officer. So the first challenge really is to deal with two people in the Foreign Service at the same time. And we currently have about 1,000 people all in who are members of what we call tandem couples. That's probably not a very nice way to talk about it, but that's how we talk about it. And over the years, we've had to change many, many regulations and ways of doing business to deal with those issues as that number has grown. So, for example, in 1998, my predecessor, I think, did a wonderful job in reassessing our whole policy toward tandem couples, and we try our best to send people to the same post. We do a much better job at this than we've done in the past, and I think that's a good thing. We also, as your listeners, I think, would understand, need to make absolutely sure, though, that we're not disadvantaging those people who are not members of tandem couples whose spouses are not in the Foreign Service. And that actually turns out to be a very tricky piece of business, as does making sure that we get all the nepotism rules right. And as people have gotten older, I mean, it was one thing when I was a junior officer and my wife was also a junior officer, but when I go out to be an ambassador suddenly, then that whole set of relationships as it applies to nepotism becomes quite tricky. And we've tried to deal with this in a way by just applying as much transparency as possible to any arrangements that we make. We try to make sure that both parts of the couple can work. Sometimes nepotism rules don't make that possible, but we do our best. The other big challenge is the one you also raised, which is dual career couples where one of the partners is not in the Foreign Service. And this is really an increasing challenge for us, and it goes back to the conversation we were having in our last segment about retention. I actually believe this is one of the key retention issues for us going forward. And we're going to have to just do a better job in making sure that employment opportunities are available for spouses. And we've got some ideas here. We've negotiated now about 137 what we call work agreements with foreign countries so that our spouses can work on the local economy. We have tried very hard to keep information flowing to those people who want to work so that they know how to apply, what's the best jobs for them. But an experiment I'd like to try, and I hope to get it done early next year, is to spend some money on a pilot post, which I'd like actually to be Mexico, where we would just pay for a headhunter. And we would say to that headhunter, we want you to work in Mexico City, and we want you to help our spouses who wish to work get jobs. And we want to try that. I don't know, really, we're trying to figure out the expense and whether people would be interested in this. But I think if we can get that done, one, it would be a good morale booster, and two, it would be a very good experiment to see actually whether this might be applied worldwide.
Earlier you talked about some of the challenges recruiting employees, and I'm wondering, how's the State Department using technology to recruit employees?
Well, we're trying to use technology more and more, Paul, and we live now in a technological age. People are not interested in sending in a self-addressed stamped envelope to find out what your business is like. They want to look on your website. So we have revamped our website for recruiting. We have also tried now to get as many people as possible signed up for the Foreign Service written exam on the internet. And I'm pleased to say that 78% of the people who took the test last Saturday did actually sign up online, and that's a good thing. Saved us actually a lot of money, and I imagine seemed more modern to all of those people. And the other thing that we've been experimenting with, which seems interesting to me, is we've also started sort of some chat rooms for people interested in the Foreign Service. And two times now with one of the internet companies, I can't remember which one, we've actually announced and had a segment where we talked about the Foreign Service and people were able to ask questions. We were there to answer them. Worked out extremely, extremely well. And on the State Department website, we know that people are interested in this because after consular affairs, after the travel warnings and travel advisories, it's recruitment that gets the most hits on our website.
How does the State Department attract a more diverse workforce?
It's something we need to do a much better job of. One of the ways that we hope to do that is to more actively go out into communities where we think that that diverse workforce lives. I have what's called diplomats in residence who go out to various universities around the country, but I don't have enough of them. And one of the things we want to do is get more diplomats in residence and then target them in areas, whether that's the Southwest or in places that are historically African-American colleges, other places, so we can bring in a diverse workforce. And to go back to Paul's point, I also think that technology ought to help us here to spread our net a lot wider. The other program that we're very, very proud of, and again set up by Secretary Albright and my predecessor, is what's called the Foreign Affairs Fellows, which is for disadvantaged students who we are actually paying for a certain amount of their education in return for, just like ROTC, a certain amount of service in the State Department. That program has worked extremely well. We have 56 Foreign Affairs Fellow and Graduate Foreign Affairs Fellow people in the State Department now, and that number, I think, is going to grow. The other place we've found where we can really have an impact on diversity is by aggressively using interns. I don't know how it is in your business, but in the summertime, really, interns run our department. And those interns now, if we can attract them from a diverse community, what do you know? They get interested in the State Department. They like their experience with the department, and then they're prepared to come back. And so I've asked our people to be much more aggressive in following up with interns. If you come to us, whether you're a sophomore in college or a junior in college, we then ought to pursue you to take the test or become part of the Foreign Affairs Fellows Program.
Earlier you talked about some of the challenges of working with spouses who are both in the Foreign Service. And what I'm wondering about is the balance between work and family. How about families within the Foreign Service and the challenges they face?
One of the things I believe that has changed for the better in the Foreign Service and really at the State Department, not just the Foreign Service, but our civil service colleagues as well, since I joined, is there's a much better balance now between work and family. And I think it's a good thing. We are trying our very best to pay attention to Foreign Service families in the same way that our military colleagues are paying much more attention to military families. I mean, we ask people to go abroad sometimes into very difficult circumstances, and the employee goes to work during the day. They work in an English-speaking, American-looking office all day. But the family is out there, and we need to do a lot more training. We need to provide more language training. We need to provide, through our overseas briefing center, a much larger ability for people to manage that. The other thing that has really now become a big issue for us, and I would assume for you all as well, is the whole question of looking after elderly parents. I mean, here again is something that when I joined the Foreign Service 26 years ago, really wasn't much of an issue. But certainly when I was the ambassador to Turkey, when I was the assistant secretary for European affairs, what do we see? More and more and more people with these responsibilities. And so again, we have just instituted a new program called Life Care, which is really based on a program of elder care, to provide for people overseas the information and support that they need if they're faced with having to manage the challenges of an elderly parent. This is an increasing challenge, and I know it's not one that we have alone, but when you're out there in Bangladesh, it's magnified, and we really need to step up to our responsibility.
Mark, you mentioned a goal of increasing training, but I am aware that you do offer quite a bit of training today. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
We offer a large array of training. Obviously, we do a lot of language training, and then we do a lot of job-specific training. If you're going to go out to be an administrative officer at one of our embassies, we can send you to a course for administrative officers. The big breakthrough in the last year, though, and I give full credit to Ruth Davis, who was also at the conference that you sponsored the other week, is she's opened now a leadership and management school at the Foreign Service Institute. And her belief is that if she can get people in training from the very beginning of their career all the way through their careers, we'll do a much better job in having the right kind of managers. And so I'm a huge supporter of this effort. One of the things that we say to people is that we have kind of a 19th century view of the profession of diplomacy, which is that anybody can do it, and that somehow any amateur can come and be a diplomat. And I don't think that's right. And we, though, have to take the first step to show that it isn't right by being aggressive, being active, and then requiring the right kind of training for our people. Again, I don't know how it is in your business, but we often make a mistake of asking people to take management positions before they've been trained to do it, and then we wonder why they don't do so well. Well, that's not their fault. That's really a responsibility of the business in your case, or the institution in our case.
Well, speaking of becoming a diplomat, could you briefly explain the oral and written exam that you take to become part of the Foreign Service and how those might change?
Well, right now, the written exam is really an effort to take a large number of people who are interested and bring that number down to a manageable number of people to interview. And we gave the test this year, last November the 4th, just a couple of weeks ago. And we had 13,000 people sign up. We're very pleased with that. And about 3,000 people will pass that test. And we'll ask those 3,000 people to come in various forms and times to have an oral interview next spring. And so we'll work through that process, and then I hope we'll be able to offer 700 or 800 of those people jobs. The budget is still a question mark, but that's our target.
Okay, great. We'll hold that thought, and we'll come back with the rest of that answer in just a minute.